Cure America, I'm Star Parker. And in 1867, American writer Mark Twain visited the Holy Land. He recorded his impressions in a book titled The Innocents Abroad. Twain was appalled when seeing the abandoned and desolate land that was the home of the Bible. He said in the book, "The further we went, the hotter the sun got, and the more rocky and bare, repulsive and dreary the landscape became." He went on to say, "There was hardly a tree or shrub anywhere. Even the olive and the cactus, those fast friends of a worthless soil, had almost deserted the country." End quote. Some 15 years later, Jews began a movement to return and restore their ancient homeland. By November 1947, the United Nations gave the green light to establish a Jewish state and an adjacent Arab state. Jews accepted the UN partitions of the region, declaring a new state of Israel in May of 1948. But the Arabs, they rejected the plan and attacked the newly declared Jewish state. Israel fought, and miraculously, they prevailed in its war of independence, and rebuilding the ancient homeland moved forward. Compared with the desolation described by Mark Twain, Israel today is a modern miracle, with per capita gross domestic product higher than that of Great Britain, France, Italy, and Spain, according to the World Bank. As of 2019, Israel had a per capita GDP of around $43,500, much higher than that of its immediate adjacent neighbors. Jordan was approximately $4,400. Egypt, about $3,000. Syria, about $2,000. Lebanon, $7,000. Israel must be doing something right. It also had the highest per capita venture capital investment in the world. During its short history, from its founding in 1948, with a population of about 800,000, to today, a population over 9 million, Israel has produced 12 Nobel Prize winners. All this while fighting three major wars and dealing with endless attacks from terrorists whose stated goal is to destroy Israel. You know, America's left and left-wing media says that Israelis oppose Palestinians under horrible conditions, and those Palestinians have no choice but to periodically explode with violence like we're seeing now, with missiles being hurled from Gaza into Israeli civilian population centers. Palestinians in Gaza do live under horrendous conditions, but not because Israelis force them to. They choose to. Israel unilaterally pulled out of Gaza in 2005 and left it under complete Palestinian control. The Palestinians could have started building, putting in place infrastructure for political and economic freedom that would allow them to produce the kind of miracle the Israelis have produced. But instead, they put Hamas in charge, Hamas terrorists, and those terrorists started shooting missiles into Israel immediately at that time. And now we're seeing it again today. So I think we should discuss what is happening in the state of Israel. What has caused this recent violence after 4 years of not seeing this? How is it similar also to what we're seeing today in America under the Black Lives Matter movement? So I'm going to speak with a really dear friend about this, Matthew Brodsky. He has more than 2 decades of experience focusing on U.S. foreign policy, national security. He's briefed members of Congress, Department of State, Department of Defense, National Security Council on Iran, on Syria, on Palestinian Israeli issues. He also worked with the Trump administration. He was a major advisor on the Abraham Accords, which is an amazing diplomatic effort to assure peace, to achieve peace in that Middle East between Israel and some of its neighbors. And we were seeing successes there. We were seeing such successes there that this turnaround under a new administration has caught us all a little bit off guard. So I'm going to talk about this with my panel of experts as well. And I'm also going to ask them, is there a relationship between the tactics that are being used by the left in the U.S. on race policy that we're also seeing being used to oppose Israel? So now let's get into this. Let's cut through the noise of the news on this big issue and find some truth today on Cure America. And we're going to do that right after this message.
Let's take a quick history lesson. Just 2 centuries ago, 94% of the people in the world lived in extreme poverty. Today, it's 8.5%. In a century, our life expectancies more than doubled. How did we come so far so fast? The freedom to create, to start a business, to keep what you earn. Don't let the socialists and radical left cost us our progress, our freedom, and our well-being. It's time we fight for America and vote for America.
Hey, it's me, Star Parker, introducing you to something brand new called Power, Poverty, and Politics. And I'm going to usually have someone in the chair next to me. What we're going to do is start looking in depth on major, major challenges in our country, but mostly through authors, people that are writing tremendous works, so that we can engage, we can educate ourselves, we can equip ourselves to do amazing things for our country, for our culture, and ultimately for the communities that are so in disarray that they just get so limited information because they've been so controlled by the hardcore left that they don't know what to do. So I'm excited about it, and we're gonna start it within the next couple of weeks, and I just wanted to give you the heads up so that you can start telling your friends, so that you can begin to face it out and to Twitter it out and to do all those other social media out that we're going to start looking at power, poverty, politics from a brand new perspective with me, Star Parker.
It's time for a cure. Cure is a coalition of new voices with new ideas that will become new policies. We are the cure. The Center for Urban Renewal and Education, headquartered in Washington, D.C., CURE works with churches, political, and business leaders on behalf of urban communities. CURE's mission is to address issues of culture, race, and poverty from a Judeo-Christian perspective. CURE, join with us. There has never been a better time to help Black communities.
Mentioned in my opening, Matthew Brodsky has more than two decades of experience in these issues we're going to talk about. U.S. foreign policy, Israeli policy, national security, and I just found out that he's writing a new book, so that means you'll see him again. Matthew, thank you. He's a senior fellow at Gold Institute for International Strategies. You worked firsthand on the development of the Abraham Accords, which a lot of people are not familiar with, that the Trump administration actually brought about an initiative, a peace initiative, and we actually started seeing some amazing things happen there in the Middle East. We're not there today. So why don't you tell us what that was, and then let's bring us to why now are they on the front page with missiles?
Well, okay, first, as to the Abraham Accords, this was a new way of thinking. The old way of thinking, which had produced zero results, was that the Palestinian issue with the Israelis is going to be the ultimate veto over the foreign relations and sovereignty of Israel, of its relations with the entire Arab world. It was also the way the United States conceived of everything, which is that the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is the center of the universe in the Middle East.
Okay. This, and only a two-state solution would solve it, is
right,
what we kept hearing.
Okay. Right. So they successive administrations pushed the same boulder up the same hill to have it fall back on them and kept trying the same thing over and over again. This administration realized that there was a new opportunity in the region for a whole host of reasons, which was that a lot of the states in the Arab world wanted to move past the conflict.
Really?
If the Fatah, Palestinian Authority corrupt government, the quote moderate government, is unable or unwilling to move forward as they were, then they should not have a veto over Israel and the United Arab Emirates or Bahrain and other countries' foreign policies. Mm-hmm. So this was to remove that from...
Okay, let me see if I'm understanding, because if I don't get it, then our audience might not as well on such a complex issue. So what you're saying is that these other players in that region were saying, hey, guys, what about us? Hey, guys, we're trying to get into, and a lot of them are very prosperous nations, no doubt, but we're trying to get into the 21st century. Can we expand the discussion? Let me ask you this. Was some of that momentum, because you said you kind of had a feeling that this was in their psyche, was that one of the reasons that the Trump administration decided to move the embassy first, and then months later we saw these Abraham Accords?
Well, moving the embassy was part of the peace strategy, which was essentially to say, by continuing to humor full maximalist Palestinian demands, and just thinking that at some point they'll clamp down off of what no Israeli government would ever accept, namely the understanding that the capital of Israel is Jerusalem, that this would essentially remove that from the situation and force the Palestinian Authority to deal with reality. I mean, the fact is, if everyone continues to indulge the fantasies that they have, then there's never going to be a solution. Part of that gave rise to what the Abraham Accords could be, developing relations, but the embassy move to Jerusalem. Look, everyone has known that the capital of Israel is Jerusalem. Right. To make peace, Egypt's president in the 70s flew to Israel, to Jerusalem, to speak in the Knesset. In Jerusalem, right. That's where you go.
And others had promised that that was going to happen. The Trump administration made it happen. We actually saw Iran have to back up a little bit. The Palestinians got a little quiet, and then we started seeing this Abraham Accord. Bring us to that moment, because, you know, I was fascinated and actually had an opportunity to be in Israel when we moved our embassy. And then I went to the White House when the Abraham Accords were signed. But I don't know that a lot of people were watching to say what really happened. What happened that these nations now flew to the country, the leaders of these nations flew to our country to say, we're signing off on a new deal, a new order. Because all we're seeing now is, it's exploding again. And the Biden administration is even trying to blame President Trump and blame the Abraham Accord. So walk us through this very, very gently so that people can understand that this is a good thing, because I think it is.
This is a huge thing. First of all, what it does is integrate Israel with the Arab world through economics, through culture, and through a common threat perception, specifically talking about Iran. That's what it does. Now, how it came to be is understanding that there was this common threat from Iran. There are Arab states, Gulf states, that are basically run with an oil-based economy. They realize the future isn't really going to be in hydrocarbons for the next hundreds of years.
Right.
They look around and see that Israel is a fantastic, innovative hub.
Incredibly so.
That they're great to partner with. They're both, I mean, the UAE and Israel are leaders in medical, in a lot of areas in business. So it made sense that these countries didn't want to allow the Fatah movement in the Palestinian Authority, which is different from Hamas, to have a veto power over this, over their relations.
Over what they wanted to do.
Right.
It's like, hey, we have countries too.
Right.
We're stuck. We're stuck 100 years in this philosophy that Israel doesn't have a right to exist. So it's interesting, because I was looking at the numbers in my column on this particular issue last week, and I mean, Israel is such a miracle. It was able to grow, and now we're seeing the GDP like amazingly higher than some of these other countries. So you mentioned the economic interests of these other countries. How much was that at the table to say, you know, Palestinians, because they did get pushback. I mean, Egypt got pushback, Iraq got pushback, Haram, I suppose they call it. How much of the economic interest to see your neighbor grow after they just showed up, and now you're still stuck in, you know, per capita in the thousands where they're in the doubles. Did that come to the table for them to say, look, we're going to break from what might be considered the norm of Muslim and or Arab interest and say we want to get a future for our youth?
That was absolutely a part of it. I mean, look, the UAE ambassador to the U.S., when he was justifying publicly the accords, he kept quoting polling that says, look, the Palestinian issue for us rates low. When we look at the polling, especially among the youth, it's like number 9 behind the economy, behind having a nice place to live, you know, quality of life.
Right.
And these are all things that by working with Israel would be have a mutual benefit.
Okay.
So this, they understood that. Now, this, of course, puts the rest of the Arab world into a difficult situation, or at least a decision point that I would argue should have come decades ago, which is Israel is here to stay. Now, it would be more beneficial for you to work with it than to continue to try to say that all of your internal problems are because of the Jewish state,
right,
which is really not even a tenable argument at this point. It's not all state-run media right now. Right. There is social media. The state can't control communications. Right. So if the state is going to tell you it's the Jewish state's fault, there are people in the states talking to each other, you know, real people. Exactly.
And especially when you start to see the growth. I've always had hope because when you think, when you look at the youth in all of these countries, they're wearing American fashion. They're listening to American music. They really want to get beyond some of the discussions from thousands of years ago. But you mentioned, especially I want to hear more about your book, because you mentioned that this was something you kind of knew going into it as you were advising with the Trump administration. How much of the, how much influence was the fact that we started doing our own oil in this country, that those decisions that the Trump administration made, that we were now producing for ourselves, that the Arab nations had to say, uh-oh, we're in a different seat right now. Maybe we ought to open our eyes and maybe open our ears to play with Israel.
That was certainly a really big factor. I mean, when we are energy independent, it allows us to say to our friends that we've been trying to say to them, you might want to diversify your economy or come more into this century's way of thinking, however you want to characterize it. When you tell them, look, we don't really need the main thing you're selling anymore.
Yeah, right,
so
right.
You're going to need, and we're the major consumer of that. So,
and Israel's moving on even without you. So,
right. Yeah, well, I mean, Israel developed its brains because it didn't have hydrocarbons to begin with. Is one of the reasons that made it a success. It had no choice but to figure out how it could be a success economically.
Do what we can. You know, I thank you, man. And I'm going to have you when your book comes out, because we've got to hear from you on this, because it's intriguing. And one of the reasons is just what you just said, not just on the blame game, but looking for resources to be successful in spite of everything else. And that's why this issue fascinates me, I think, because what we hear from the Palestinians is what we hear from BLM in the inner cities here in America. And we've just got to get beyond that messaging and say, hey, whatever gifts we have, we're going to use them too. So, you know, let's just do it. Whatever talents we have, we can make something beautiful out of them. So thank you for being with us. And I'll see you again very soon, because this book is going to be out very soon. And I'll be right back with my panel to continue in this discussion about the Israeli conflict that we're seeing today on the front pages.
Yes, I have thought an awful lot about blowing up the White House.
Hello, I'm Franklin Graham. We've got a new year in front of us, 2021, and new opportunities. But for many, we've got the same old problem. There's that emptiness in your heart, and you've been trying to fill it with drugs and alcohol and sex and everything else, but it just doesn't work. You've been searching, but you don't even know what you're searching for. God is the only one who can fill that vacuum. If you've never trusted His Son, Jesus Christ, as your Savior, do that today. You see, Jesus took our sins. He died on the cross. He was buried, and God raised Him to life. And He can come into your heart and change you and forgive you. Just pray this prayer with me right now. Just say, God, I'm a sinner. I'm sorry. Forgive me. I believe Jesus is your Son, and I want to trust Him today as my Savior. I want to invite Him to come into my life and take control. If you prayed that prayer, call that number that's on the screen. Do it right now. Call that number. Someone's willing to speak with you right now. Call that number. God bless.
Well, a lot of us did see some movement toward peace during the Trump administration, but in the last 6 months with the Biden administration, immediately things started erupting again. And so I have some very special panelists discuss this with us. And then I want to transition into some of the things we're hearing on the campuses that are happening in all across this country that are very, very disturbing. So, of course, I have Jonathan Alexandre with us. You know him as a senior counsel for governmental affairs at Liberty Counsel Action, but he also, prior to going there, he was at the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs. So he's a specialist on this issue as well. So thank you. I wanted to get your ideas on this one, to switch in hats a little bit, because you've been on those religious liberty issues a whole lot, but this is very serious what we're starting to see, and especially with the progressives in the Congress that are just forcing the hand of their colleagues on these questions of Israel. So we want to talk to you about that. But I also want to talk to Jack Biwer. He is new to me and to you. He is a news writer at the Washington Free Beacon. It's an online news source that produces in-depth investigative reporting on a wide range of issues, including public policy, government affairs, international security, the media. Thank you for coming. Because, Jack, it's interesting that as I got into what you guys are doing at the Washington Free Beacon, it's like, whoa, these are my folks. So thank you for sharing. Yeah, and it's an online news source. So we're going to look at that, you guys, because they are speaking truth and that we need to know about. I haven't seen it in other newspapers, and it's important that we get ahead of things that we're hearing now, like the critical race theory and all the stuff that ends up in Washington. We're like, when and where did this start? Well, it started a long time ago, and that's why I'm also very honored to have Benjamin Weil with us. Thank you. He's the director of the Project for Israeli National Security at the Endowment for Middle East Truth. Okay, I'm going to have to say that again. You're the director of the Project for Israeli National Security at the Endowment for Middle East Truth. See, the reason I have to say it again is because I don't know the group like that. I know it as EMET, and I've known EMET forever. You guys, I'm on your list. You guys do incredible work. I've even been to some of the forums that you've done throughout the years to try to let people know about what's happening in Israel, the relations that we have here in America, and what EMET is a public policy think tank here based in Washington, D.C. So I thank you, Benjamin, for coming in. Our paths may have crossed before. I'm very concerned about what we're seeing and hearing that I don't think we've had too much of before, to where we had a squad in the Congress who is really going to push the envelope. So tell us a little bit about what you guys have been looking at, what you've been doing, and what should we be thinking about?
So first of all, thank you very much for having me today, Star. I will say that one of the trends that we've noticed actually in the Middle East is a lot of our foes over there will look at what's going on in the United States and start using that as a tool against us here. Mm-hmm. So when they see the Black Lives Matter movement or BDS or whatever it may be, they use that as a tool to attack the United States and cut off any credibility that the United States has to preach to others about freedom, about democracy, about human rights, etc. So having a radical squad in Congress and expressing these very radical opinions, that's used as ammunition against us later by our adversaries in the region and even against our allies in the region, such as Israel and more.
Wait, am I hearing you correctly? What you're saying is that part of the reason we're hearing all this hatred to America is to diminish our credibility around the world so that they can keep the tensions going in the Middle East?
That's precisely right. This is used as fuel for our adversaries to then go and preach to us how we have no right to spread freedom if there are voices in our own Congress and in some streets that are saying that United States is not a free country.
And you know, it's interesting because, and Jonathan, I want you to get to this, because I have felt that about why it is that they keep painting that black life doesn't work in America and what message it sends out to the rest of the world. But before I come to you on that, I really want you to weigh in on that one. But Jack, the Washington Free Beacon, you guys are pointing to a lot of what's happening with relating back to what Benjamin just said and mentioned the BDS movement, which I don't think anyone may know what it is. So I want you to weigh in on that, because this is almost frightening that there's just this consistency between the voices that we're hearing from Squad and from the hard left and from the progressives and from what we're seeing on these campuses. And you alluded to, and we're going to get to all of this new energy against Jewish people in this country. But explain to us, what is it about this BDS? What is it that you guys have been noticing and wanting to get out to the public?
No, that's exactly right, Star. And in a lot of ways, it seems to me the BDS has been sort of a long time coming. We've been covering this in the background.
And it's the boycott.
That's right.
Okay,
yeah.
Tell them what
the
it
boycott,
is.
The boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. So essentially, it's this idea propagated by many activists that American businesses, American colleges, institutions in American life shouldn't be investing money in Israel. We should be taking that money and putting it somewhere else. We should be sort of freezing our assets from Israel.
Because they keep calling it apartheid state, and they're
right.
colonialists,
yeah.
and all of these other things. The yeah. language and the similar language that we keep hearing, you know, from the hard black left. And so it's called BDS, boycott, divest, sanction. It's in the colleges.
Yeah. It's also in our Congress. Let me point you to one story that would be, I think, really useful for you here is the chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Elliot Engel, the former chairman, New Yorker, a longtime pro-Israel Democrat, was primaried out of Congress a couple years back by Jamal Bowman, who has flirted with BDS for several years. And I think as we see with some of the reporting we've done at the Beacon, it's all over the place.
It's all over the place. And what's interesting, because they actually, once they won, because there were two of them running at that time that are joining the squad. And you guys are not following this maybe succinctly because you're raising your families and you're going to church on Sunday morning and all the rest of the things we're supposed to do in our lives, but we need to watch what's going on, because now you're fighting the critical race theory and wonder how it started. And that's why I wanted to spend some time on this BDS movement, because it's so similar. It stays under radar. It gets into colleges, then it gets into corporate, and then it comes to the rest of us in the nation. And so, and Jonathan, this is alarming. And I know as a constitutional lawyer, you're following many, many other issues over there at Liberty, but this one's into your heart as well, because you're working on these Jerusalem issues. So tell us a little bit about your thoughts and how these things are interrelated. And then on the other side of break, we'll get to what do we do about it?
Yeah, absolutely. And mentioning the squad is so critical, where you have ancient anti-Semitic tropes now being regurgitated by the members of the squad and finding themselves in policy in the United States. And of course, you know, they use the idea of victimhood. They try to attach it to the BLM movement, saying that there is equal victimhood happening for Palestinians in Israel. And any objective look by any metric as to what's actually occurring in Israel, even by international law standard, even by laws of armed conflict standard, you're seeing an Israel that treats its citizens well, an open Israel that allows for Arab participation. You have an Arab on the Supreme Court. You have Arabs that are able to work. They recognize that Israel, in its prosperity, gives even Palestinians the opportunity to travel into Jerusalem and work. So by any objective metric that you look at the situation, you can, you know, refuse what the squad has done and certainly what is infiltrating into U.S. policy in terms of castigating Israel as being an oppressor or developing a life in Israel that's untenable for Palestinians to live in.
Well, we know that that's not true. And in fact, when I visited on one of my trips, I was fascinated even in the diversity of Jewish people. I mean, there were some dark as me with machine guns on their back because they were 17 and had to go serve in the military. So, Benjamin, I'm wondering what is going on deeper. Why is it now that we're seeing not just the venom that has continued from in the Middle East, but now on our campuses, to where now I don't even know if a Jewish person walking in New York City can feel safe anymore because of this tension that is expressing itself through the campuses, through this squad. And those of you that don't know who these squads are, you need to stop voting for them. So you need to find out. But what in the world is it?
I think that one of the most recent changes that here in the United States has definitely not helped the anti-BDS movement is an administration that's not willing to take a strong stand against it. Or when you see today a lot of politicians on Capitol Hill who are afraid to speak out in favor of Israel or against anti-Semitism because they fear what the extreme politicians on their side of the aisle will think or say about them, or whether they'd be smeared on media.
They will. I mean, you were just telling me a moment ago during the break that there was a campus situation to where they wanted to speak out on behalf of Israel and venom. They shut down your home now. And so tell us a little bit about some of the stories that that some might not be hearing but are happening.
Yeah, so that's exactly right. In the recent escalation between Israel and Hamas, there was an uptick around the world, but even over here in the United States, in anti-Semitism. And the campus on Rutgers, they issued a statement that was against the rise of anti-Semitism and the instances that occurred. And they were forced to retract that because of pressure of pro-Palestinian, pro-BDS movements and organizations. And I think it's really sad that we've come to a place where we can't even agree that anti-Semitism, or which is a form, if you will, of racism, is something that that we cannot tolerate. If we can't agree on that, then I don't know what we can agree on.
You know, especially coming out of this new administration, that just within the last couple of weeks, we see this whole thing on, we've got to stop the anti-Asian harassment. And now when we see what's happening to Jewish people in our country because of this uptick, it's silence or it's backlash, because I've seen a couple of instances. I didn't know about the one, but I've seen a couple of instances. So Jack, this, what I'm seeing that you guys are reporting is that there is even a relationship between this BDS, the people involved in that movement, and the people involved in this critical race theory. Explain to me what it is they're after.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, there's a certain worldview there. There's oppressed and there's oppressors. And so that's extended almost, I think, to the issues with Israel. And we see this not just in the United States. This is making Israelis less safe. Many of the students that are coming through these schools are getting great jobs in Silicon Valley at these companies like Google, at Amazon. And these same, don't forget their activism. And they write letters to the CEOs of these companies, many of whom have contracts with the IDF, telling them, we don't want our companies to have anything to do with the IDF. We want to be out of there in the same way that, you know, we're seeing this language with BDS on college campuses. So it doesn't just stay on campus, as we well know. It's everywhere.
So they're pressuring that now you can't even hire. You can't even, and that's where we know that they're going, because when you start hearing even congressional leaders say, oh no, this is like apartheid, then it moves it into a whole new space to where, you know, it's basically segregation, it's cancellation, Jonathan.
Yeah, cancellation is a good word. The gross hypocrisy by much in the social media, allowing these anti-Semitic hashtags, stab Israeli, stab Jews. They allowed these hashtags to go on in the past 2 weeks. They were late to the punch. TikTok was late to the punch. Facebook, Twitter was all late to the punch in ultimately canceling these hashtags. These are the hashtags that folks in Israel, Palestinians in Israel, and even in the United States, when we saw an uptick in anti-Semitism, these are the hashtags that motivated them. There were stab Jewish challenges that would go around. I mean, and canceling, you know, if there's one thing that should be removed from the internet, not being able to share, is these hashtags or these trending topics.
Well, they say that they have these monitors to make sure that no hate is there. That sounds like hate. You had a comment. I think you were.
Yes, I want to say something about the anti-Semitism, especially about the apartheid. Sorry, especially today, okay. Because just yesterday there was a new government in Israel that is about to be formed, actually, and one of the main parties in this new government is an Arab party. So I don't know how all these critics will say that Israel is an apartheid state when you have chief justices, you have generals in the military, you have a political party that's part of a future government governing the state of Israel, ministers who are all Arab, and I don't accept that language. And I think that there's a huge difference between the apartheid that occurred in South Africa and where Israel is today.
We know there is. It's just the languaging. It's like we're dealing with now. It's like if you mention Jim Crow long enough, people will get afraid enough and then they'll do what you want, which is purge your companies of any dissent and all these other things. But you know what's interesting about what you said, this coalition that has built within your own country, the diversity that's in your own country is so similar to our own. Are we going to hear from these other Arab states that signed up to the Abraham Accords? What are your guys' thoughts on that? Because maybe to hear from some other Arabs to say, hey, wait a minute, guys, we're in the 21st century now.
Yeah, I think it's so critical to mention the Arab Accords, the Abraham Accords with Arab states, the first in a generation, probably in a lifetime, that you have Arab states saying that we want to have normalized relationships with Israel. Of course, United Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, those are states that you'd recognize, but to have Sudan come in. Sudan was the location of the three no's in Khartoum back in 1967, where a majority of Arab states said they would never recognize Israel, they would never have peace with Israel, and they would never talk to Israel. They would not engage or recognize Israel. And they all agreed to this. So to have Sudan come around in full 180, change direction, and say, we now want to normalize relationships with Israel. That's all done under the Trump administration. Unfortunately, you have Biden administration come in and say, well, that had no sign of progress. There was nothing gained from the Abraham Accords.
You gotta wonder how we moved from, there was nothing to gain from the Abraham Accords, where we didn't see what we saw just over the last couple of weeks, exactly. Missiles and all this other stuff. And then yet we're now looking at, under the Biden administration, the increase in all the tensions, even here on our own campuses. We only have about 50 seconds. So what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna take a little break right now, and then we're gonna come back and continue this, because I wanna know, and I want you guys to dig deeper for me, who is this Justice Democrats that are funding all of this stuff in our country, and see if we can kind of expose them so that they will stop, or they'll know that they're being exposed, so that we can get the people that are electing them that haven't thought through it real deeply. Who are these folks and why are they creating so much havoc? Because what's really fascinating, guys, is the districts that these squads represent are in total chaos. It's not like the Palestinians can't fix what they own over there, because they have all of Gaza. So we need to look at the similarities here and get behind who these mad people are that are now in our Congress that are continuing to divide so that they can conquer for whatever agenda. We'll be right back after this message.
It's time for a cure. Cure is a coalition of new voices with new ideas that will become new policies. We are the cure. The Center for Urban Renewal and Education, headquartered in Washington, D.C., CURE works with churches, political, and business leaders on behalf of urban communities. CURE's mission is to address issues of culture, race, and poverty from a Judeo-Christian perspective. CURE, join with us. There has never been a better time to help Black communities.
Hey, it's me, Star Parker, introducing you to something brand new called Power, Poverty, and Politics. And I'm going to usually have someone in the chair next to me. What we're going to do is start looking in depth on major, major challenges in our country, but mostly through authors, people that are writing tremendous works, so that we can engage, we can educate ourselves, we can equip ourselves to do amazing things for our country, for our culture, and ultimately for the communities that are so in disarray that they just get so limited information because they've been so controlled by the hardcore left that they don't know what to do. So I'm excited about it, and we're gonna start it within the next couple of weeks, and I just wanted to give you the heads up so that you can start telling your friends, so that you can begin to face it out and to Twitter it out and to do all those other social media out, that we're going to start looking at power, poverty, politics from a brand new perspective with me, Star Parker. There's a lot of things that we were talking about during the break that I'm like, oh, I forgot to let them know about that. Uh-oh, because you might not even know what we're talking about with the missiles going back and forth, what the IDF stands for. So we're going to get more into it with our panel, because you got to understand this, you know, especially as Bible believers, there's a part of the Bible that says there's not peace there, there's not peace here. So I have Jonathan with us. Jonathan Alexandre, you know, as senior government affairs at Liberty Council, but he's also Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs. That's where he was before he went over to Liberty. So he's been studying these issues. He's been impassioned by these issues. So thank you for bringing your insight on that. Jack Byer, news writer at the Washington Free Beacon. It's an online news source that I now am exposed to and I'm excited about. And we're going to be watching their news because they're giving us insight into places we haven't been. And so thank you for coming and being with us. And then Benjamin Weil, director of a project at EMET. Okay, E-M-E-T. What is your website, actually?
It's emetonline.org.
emetonline.org.
We have a lot of fact sheets on all of these subjects that we're discussing now. Okay. For your audience, if they'd like more information and gain more insight, and weekly webinars on all these hot topics.
Oh, awesome, because this is an audience that's very concerned about Israel. And then they saw, you know, Jonathan, as you mentioned, a break. Did they even know that what happened, that tit for tat? We might have just heard that, okay, it stopped at a certain point. So Emmet, you call it?
Emmet.
I call it Emmet. And that's the Endowment for Middle East Truth. Okay, and so you want to Emmet?
Emmet is the Hebrew word for truth as well.
Oh.
So it's a play on words over there.
Really? Really?
You speak the truth, facts only.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So that's a think tank you want to get on their website, especially if you're impassioned by this, and pastors, especially you, because you're not getting half the news. We're not getting the news. And it's getting bigger and bolder. And now we're even getting headlines that there's a rift in the Democrat Party, because as you heard coming into this segment, that there's a pushing them out. They're actually, in fact, I think that you mentioned that, Jack. So tell us what happened. This Justice Democrat, they are a pack. They're backing these left-wing Democrat candidates. They endorsed two that just got in. This one from New York, this one from, I think, Missouri. Actually replacing Black caucus members with radical extremists. And they are behind the squad. Those of you that don't know it, that's that Ocasio-Cortez, that's Presley out of Massachusetts, that's Omar out of Minnesota, that's Tlaib out of Michigan. We're in trouble.
No, absolutely right. And in a lot of ways, I mean, these are folks who aren't extremists in the Democratic Party. They have their hands in the levers of power. Ilhan Omar has a seat on the Foreign Affairs Committee. So she's in a position where she can dictate to a degree or have some control over the policy line that the Democratic Party is bringing out on these subjects.
And this subject is real. And in fact, I think that we move so quickly as a nation from the extreme of the BLM to where they put everybody on notice that you speak out against us, your kids are at risk. And then we move straight into this, where I don't know if it was anticipated that, Jonathan, I think you've been following the actual details of what happened. What happened that we saw that Gaza just thought that they should start a war with Israel?
Yeah. Why we see this in the headlines is because, you know, there was a war. There was an 11-day war, you know, initiated by Hamas terrorists, launching missiles into Israel, attacking Israeli population centers, intentionally attacking areas where you have Israeli civilians that have just seconds between hearing a siren and being able to run into your bunker, because you're literally being showered with missiles. If it wasn't for the Iron Dome, this system that repels in midair, literally sending out a bullet to hit another bullet, if it wasn't for this Iron Dome system, you'd have massive casualties of Israelis, as Hamas, a terrorist organization, sending 4,300 rockets intentionally targeting Israeli civilians. And when Israel retaliates, as any sovereign nation should, having the right to defend themselves, then you hear this false equivocation, this moral saying Israel is not morally justified in defending himself. And ultimately, you find the headlines that we're reading and finding its way into Congress and policy, castigating Israel and saying that they're the bad actors in all this.
But why now? Go ahead.
I would just like to add that it's Hamas, it's the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Those are the two main parties in Gaza Strip. And what a lot of the pro-Palestinian advocates or even legislators in Capitol Hill forget is that the two main things that Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad are doing is, number one, shooting from a civilian population in Gaza Strip, which is a violation of international law. And then the other thing they're doing is they're shooting indiscriminately into a civilian population in Israel, which is also a violation of international law. And somehow the Palestinians or Hamas in Gaza is the victim, even though they're committing two grave international, breaching two international laws over there, while Israel, all they're doing is shooting missiles to defend themselves and destroying infrastructure that belongs to terrorists and that helps these terrorist organizations.
Let me ask you this then, because this happened. Why now? 4 years we've had what we might call a little bit of peace, and where is the international community? Why isn't Europe speaking up? And then I asked you earlier about the Arab nations, that maybe they're like, yikes, what do we do here? But where is Europe on this if they're violating these types of treaties and conditions of war?
Well, Europe for the past decade or so, or since this whole, what's called in Arabic an intifada, since this whole wave of violence has started in the early 2000s, they have pretty much backed the Palestinians with this notion that Israel is an occupier, Israel is an aggressor. So I'm not that surprised to see that the Europeans, whether through finances or political actions, are backing the Palestinians. I will note that there are some countries like Hungary, for instance, that have become very close to Israel and have been helping Israel in the UN, in the EU, and trying to work together, at least until the end of the Trump administration, to work together in trying to facilitate a stronger foreign policy towards Israel to bring more peace and stability. Mm-hmm. Because as long as this conflict continues, there won't be rest in that land. And the only way that can happen is if we exterminate all of the terrorist activities, all the organizations over there, and rebuild so that all the money that does pour into the Palestinians doesn't go to build tunnels and fund rockets, right, but goes towards education, welfare, medical health and systems and the health system in general. I think that that's what will bring the peace, is once they put down their weapons and use that money to rebuild themselves.
Well, and they need to recognize that that's their responsibility now. Israel did give up a lot to let them go build, you know, and you have the ability to do that. And I'm glad to hear that about Hungary, because we're hearing some good signs about what's happening under their new leadership. But I'm wondering as well that the international community taking the position that you're taking has to be little caught off guard, that the minute the Trump administration leaves, that now we're seeing this again. How then is our administration saying, well, maybe the answer is to get back in a deal with Iran?
Yeah. And that's real time and place. Iran has its hand on the lever. They have the strings on the puppet. They're carefully watched, if not funded, but carefully watched what's going on in Hamas. Certainly they have full stake on the northern border of Israel on the other side. Iran.
Okay.
Full stake on the northern border of Israel, where they're funding Hezbollah. Watching how Israel responded to Hamas, saying, well, you know, this is the amount of rockets that Israel send out. This is Israel self-restraining itself. Ooh. They're planning and masterminding what they've always said they wanted to do, Iran, which is attack and ultimately eliminate Israel. What the Biden administration has been soft in doing, but what it should do and about face and do is remain away from the Iran deal. This is something that Trump pulled us out of. It was good to be pulled out of. Iran has never changed its perspective on trying to amass weapons. It has never stopped its funding of terrorism across the world. It's never going to be an ally for peace in the area. It's always going to be the instigator. And that's one place to start.
Well, I think I want to hear your thought, and then I'm going to go to Jack on because he mentioned worldview. So I'm going to ask him about that. But get your thought out.
Yeah, and speaking of the international community, just last Thursday, the Human Rights Council of the UN decided to investigate Israel for war crimes as a result of the most recent escalation.
No.
And the two most interesting things about that are, number one, is that there were 60 some countries that called for this probe. And all but one are ranked below Israel on their human freedom index.
How are they even taken seriously? Right. This is crazy mad.
Exactly. And the second interesting part of this is that they only call to investigate Israel, but not Hamas. So they're only investigating one side of this conflict. And from the date where Israel started retaliating and responding.
And it was a response. Hamas started this conflict. That's like you guys are getting ready to fight, and then you find the one that started the fight, but you go after the other one. I think it comes down to what you said, Jack, worldview. Talk into that, because there's something deeper behind this. That it's not just this has been 2,000 years ago, 6,000 years of them always fighting. No, this is deeper than that. This is a worldview, and it's here in this country. It's connected to Israel. It just seems like that whole Judeo-Christian ethic is under attack.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, when you look at the way the education system functions in this country, or is supposed to function, it's about teaching civics, about teaching history, about forming good citizens. In recent years, I mean, you see these things with the 1619 Project included in many schools. We're rethinking what history means to our students. And so if we're equipping students with an inability to process history the right way, to see things in the way that they should be seen, we're going to be having to make poor decisions about policy.
Well, because some might not have been following this news on the 1619, because this is part of the theory that's been driving some of this critical race theory that we also see in this BDS theory, but it is rooted in a worldview. But explain a little bit about, because in my opinion, why we're having this discussion in our history books is because, or what history should look like. As America, we were founded on that Judeo-Christian principle. We have a system of capitalism that accompanies it, means free markets. And then you put a rule of law in place, and it works in countries where you do that, regardless of how diverse they are. I mean, it works in Israel, works here, works in what we call democracies. But so get a little bit more deeper into what you were telling us right now, because you see the insight. But if you're talking to someone who's like, I don't understand that. What happened? I just get up and go to church on Sunday morning and believe it. And now they're seeing their whole worldview personally attacked But it is rooted in this 1619. We have people that are just simply evil and trying to rewrite everything.
No, I think that's right. And part of it as well is you have a lot of these sort of well-meaning college administrators who might believe a lot of the same things that, we're talking about in a positive light here, but are frankly afraid a lot of times to voice.
So they're well-meaning, but they're afraid.
Right, because you have these student activists who are drafting these letters.
I don't know if I can call them well-meaning.
They can't be well-meaning if they're afraid. I mean, just like if you know truth, which we just heard that amen is truth, but you're afraid to say it, then I don't know which is worse, the person that's saying it, that I know you're my enemy, or the person that's like, I know the truth, but I'm not going to tell you.
And it's from top down. Yes, it's student activism, but the administration and the professors that start with Holocaust denial in your first year of many institutions.
That's
they're insidious. They do not have the best intention of telling the right story of history when it comes to these college campuses.
Okay, we only have a couple of minutes. This segment went so fast. How do we turn around? What do we do?
I think that education is the first place to go. The education system, you have textbooks, and this is in the Palestinian Authority, but even here in the United States as well, textbooks and professors who express only one political view about some of these matters. And I think that we have to call for either abolishing that or some sort of diversification so that we can expose students and these young students who then, as you mentioned, later become policymakers and decision makers and executives of big companies to then be more educated and see that their point of view is not the only point of view, and that it's most likely that it's at the other point of view that's correct. And they ought to know that this is not the world view on anti-Semitism or on Israel or whatever topic it is.
You know, I agree that when once the light comes in, people then make better decisions. And that's probably why they fight so hard to keep us out of, not just on the campuses and the truth on these campuses. The Trump administration tried to build an alternative to that 1619 by doing the 1776 that Biden got rid of immediately. So speaking to the media plays a role in this too. We're not seeing truth there as well. What can we do?
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, in the coverage of this conflict, we've seen so much coverage of casualties going on in the Gaza Strip, and very little about civilians who've been killed by Hamas rockets in Israel. And so, you know, if the American people fundamentally don't know what's going on, how are they going to make good decisions about electing Congress people or calling their Congress people about what's going on?
So I guess we have to go to the Washington Free Beacon. They can go there. What's that website?
That's right, freebeacon.com.
Freebeacon.com, because that's where we're going to find out a little bit more. And then what else do we do?
Two things. Weigh everything you see and read about Israel by objective standards. International law, Israel always passes the test. By financial standard, Israel's going to pass the test. Look at the amount of companies they have on our own stock market. But culturally, I think there's one thing that practically that we can do, if able, is to travel to Israel yourself. I know that something that every one of us has done on this panel. We've been to Israel. We've seen the sites from a Christian biblical perspective, walk where Jesus walked, and then get a political understanding about the terrain and why it should be under Jewish control. Be able to interact with a huge diverse population, the Ethiopians, the Arabs, the Jews, that all make part of the Jewish state, be able to interact with them and see what is actually going on the ground.
And then Gaza, because when one of the trips that I made there, they had given up more land, Israel, because they keep being talked into doing this, and then it was under this control, you couldn't get in there. And then it was trashed by then. It was like almost everything that was beautiful, they're going the opposite direction. So what can you say, Willie, I have like 40 seconds, about Gaza? Can they build? We hear the same thing about those Palestinians that we hear about Black people, that you're just a bunch of victims, you can't do this.
Unfortunately, it's a political calculation. If Hamas is going to be in power, they want a chokehold on the Gazan people. They use it to their benefit, to their propaganda.
The people have
benefit.
The ability to build. Let's take Hamas out. Let's take the Black Caucus out. Let's take all these so-called leaders out of this and say, because I think a lot of it's rooted in, but they don't have the capacity.
Anytime the U.S. has sent money there, that money has been taken by Hamas and used to build tunnels to funnel rockets into Israel.
But people themselves, the Palestinians, God has distributed to them gifts and talents too, right?
Absolutely.
So if they wanted to get good leadership, they can do exactly what their neighbor Israel did. Can't they?
They can, and they want to, I believe.
And they want to. Then that gives us hope, because if they really want to, then we're going to let them. We're going to support them. So thank you. Thank you so much, Benjamin.
Thank you,
Jack. Thank you, Jonathan, for being here. And I'll be right back with some final thoughts.
Let's take a quick history lesson. Just two centuries ago, 94% of the people in the world lived in extreme poverty. Today, it's 8.5%. In a century, our life expectancies more than doubled. How did we come so far so fast? The freedom to create, to start a business, to keep what you earn. Don't let the socialists and radical left cost us our progress, our freedom, and our well-being. It's time we fight for America and vote for America.
Yes, I have thought an awful lot about blowing up the White House.
Time for a cure. Cure is a coalition of new voices with new ideas that will become new policies. We are the cure. The Center for Urban Renewal and Education, headquartered in Washington, D.C., Cure works with churches, political, and business leaders on behalf of urban communities. Cure's mission is to address issues of culture, race, and poverty from a Judeo-Christian perspective. Cure, join with us. There has never been a better time to help Black communities.
Perfect world, it's so much easier to hate and blame than to take personal responsibility to create and build. We're seeing what's happening in Israel here in our own country. We're Black Lives Matters movement and the political left embracing critical race theory, which peddles the distortion and lies that American history is about a dominant, oppressive white class rather than an ongoing struggle for all to take personal responsibility to prevail under freedom. Worse, those who choose to buy into the great lie that their lives are about what others do rather than what they choose get paid off politically and in lawsuits resulting from inevitable tragedies that emerge from this culture of irresponsibility. Similarly, Palestinian terrorists get paid off by sponsored terrorist nations such as Iran, and through massive foreign aid from confused left-wing dominated Western countries. Subsidize and blame and irresponsibility produces squalor, a culture of hard work and personal responsibility, despite a world that is often unclear and often seems unfair and unjust. This produces miracles like the modern state of Israel. We're standing with Israel here at Cure America, and I hope you will too. And I hope you'll join us again next week when we take on another important topic so that we can cure America.